few weeks ago, I stopped at a deli for a sandwich, and I found myself in line behind two girls, maybe mid-teens, who were talking loudly enough for me to overhear, actually loudly enough for most of the people in the deli to overhear. They were discussing their summers. "I'm so bored," one of them said. "I'm going to be home all week and there's nothing to do." I smiled to myself, remembering the annual angst of early summer when my own children were in high school. But the conversation continued, and it turned out that the reason that this young woman was so bored that week was that she had spent the previous week in Key West and was getting ready to leave the next week for a month-long camping experience in the Canadian Rockies. At that point, her ennui seemed a little less charming. But as I thought further, I reasoned that between the Keys and the Canadian Rockies, the familiarity of a New York apartment, as wonderful as it may be, might seem a little routine and boring. The high moments of our lives, after all, we cherish and remember, and the low moments we're forced to contend with and thus remember, but we're likely to forget the more commonplace, ordinary times of our lives. What's to remember, after all, because they are so, well, mundane. The moment in the deli reminded me that there was a period of time when our family was young, when we spent a few moments at supper time each evening hearing reports from each family member on what they had been doing during the day. That worked for a few years, it didn't work forever. What special things had each done, interesting people we'd met, perhaps something we'd learned that day. One such supper conversation is still etched in my memory all these years later. It was a midsummer evening when our children were young. Our son told of the friends with whom he had spent the day and the games they had played. Marla cataloged all the things that she and our then four-year-old daughter had done. They had gone to the park, they had run some errands, they had visited a neighbor, they played some games, they worked a puzzle, they'd done some shopping, they'd spent some time with, you get it. I mean, it's the whole litany of things that a mother of a preschooler does in a day. And then it was our daughter's turn, and so I said, "What about your day, hon? What did you do today?" And without even looking up from her plate of spaghetti, she said, "Not much." I thought for a moment I would have to restrain Marla after that comment, but in the years since then, that night, her comment has served as a reminder to me of what we notice and what we miss in our mundane, ordinary days. It was more than just the mindless comment of a four-year-old. I'm willing to wager that all of us have had days like that, maybe even recently. Days when we have moved frenetically from place to place and event to event and task to task, and yet at the end of the day felt as if we had done not much. Common, ordinary days when nothing very unusual had happened. Days laced perhaps with familiar routines and with the usual faces and voices, with the same old skirmishes and hassles. And I suspect that for many people, the majority of their days are spent that way. The summer heat only magnifies the problem, and along the way we may find ourselves in seasons of discontent, a bit bored or restless or even mildly depressed. And on such days, we may feel the way Samuel Butler felt when he wrote, "Life is just one long process of getting tired." Perhaps it was one of those ordinary days in the life that, in his life, that the psalmist penned what we now know as the 90th Psalm. There's no mistaking the firm faith of this poet. He readily affirms from the beginning that God has been our dwelling place in all generations. But there's also lament here about the transience of human life, about its brevity and its sorrow, days wasted, too soon gone. You sweep mortals away, he says, they're like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, and in the evening it fades and withers. The years of our lives are 80 years, or even by reason of strength, 80. And yet even their span is only toil and trouble. They're soon gone, and we fly away. Most of us have known days of toil and trouble. Some of us have known years like that. Common, ordinary years full of common, ordinary, and fleeting days, seemingly devoid of direction and joy. And yet, in the midst of his lament, the psalmist also reaches deep into the reservoirs of his mature faith, and in thinking about such ordinary days, makes a request of God. So teach us, he says, to number our days, that we may gain a wise heart. Lord, don't let us waste any of the days you have given us. Don't let us get so caught up in the routine that we miss the special opportunities inherent in each day. Teach us to number our days in gratitude, that we might apply the wisdom of your grace to our living. In one of Clyde Edgerton's novels, a character named Grove McCord made a simple yet profound observation. He said, "You are history longer than you are fact. You're history longer than you are fact." He's right, of course. We are history longer than we're fact, but rather than depress us, that maxim should enliven us and open our eyes and our ears and our hearts to the grace and the abundance that accompany all of our days in this history that we're writing. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a wise heart. The Scottish writer John O'Donohue argues that not living into such wisdom, not living life as fully and as open to the Spirit as possible, is more than a shame. It is, he says, a sin. He writes of being at the deathbed of a friend who was so full of regret, who was longing for another year to do some of the things his heart had always dreamed of doing. He thought of his friend and then says, "We are so privileged, most of us, still to have time. We have but one life, and it's a shame to limit it by fear and false barriers." Irenaeus, a wonderful philosopher and theologian in the second century, said, "The glory of God is a person fully alive." O'Donohue says the divine has such passionate creativity and instinct for the fully inhabited life. The fully inhabited life. What a wonderful phrase. What a helpful antidote to the deadening complaints and the deep-seated resentments and restlessness with which many face the progress of their days. The fully inhabited life may well be another way of naming the heart of wisdom that the psalmist sees as flowing from a faithful counting of our days. Such counting roots us in a sense of dependence upon God's grace. Moreover, it leads us to the recognition that every day, every moment is a gift of God, that God invests even the most ordinary days of our lives with extraordinary grace. The psalmist prays that God will grant the wisdom of knowing our limits, the wisdom to set aside the temptation of a depressed or disappointed view of life with an affirmation of life as a gift, so that we may fully inhabit those days. When we claim such wisdom, the ordinary takes on extraordinary dimensions. The commonplace becomes the arena for special glimpses into the workings of grace. The naturalist and poet Annie Dillard years ago described such a moment when she happened upon an everyday occurrence in the life of a bird in her neighborhood. She had just rounded a corner of her house, she said, when she saw a mockingbird step off the second story rain gutter and drop. With wings folded tightly at its side, it looked like it was going to smash headlong right into the ground. But then, just at the last moment, it spread its wing and broadened its tail and floated onto the grass. There was nothing remarkable, Dillard said, and yet it was remarkable indeed. And she wondered how many such moments passed by without anyone even noticing. The answer must be, she said, that beauty and grace are performed all around us all the time. The least we can do is try to be there. Part of our vocation as God's people is to try to be there, to pay attention to the passing moments of our lives, and to sense what God is up to try to sense God's comforting presence in a fearful time of loss, to try to see in the face of a laughing child the very face of God, to sense in the embrace of a loved one God's embrace, to count every good memory as a fortifying gift. Part of our vocation, friends, is to inhabit fully our days. If we can employ our senses to be more in touch with God's grace in seemingly mundane, ordinary times, I believe it will help us to begin to feel more of a kinship with the teacher who noticed grace in the commonplace, in lilies of the field and birds of the air, who phrased his message in terms of common, everyday events. A woman sweeping a floor looking for a lost coin, a shepherd watching sheep, passers-by on a road, a father running to embrace his son. Ordinary people on ordinary days doing ordinary things that were not really ordinary at all, but were noticed. And it was that same teacher who took the ordinary table stuff of his time, bread and wine, and shaped them into signs and channels of extraordinary grace, then offered them to us all as the means for the redemption of every ordinary day, of every fleeting moment of our lives. Some of you are old enough to remember Ogden Nash. Ogden Nash gained fame for his light, humorous verse, poking fun at those ordinary moments and relationships that comprise our days. Brief poems like The Fly. The Lord in his wisdom made the fly and then forgot to tell us why. Or his brief A Word to Husbands. To keep your marriage brimming with love in the loving cup, whenever you're wrong, admit it. Whenever you're right, shut up. Most of the time, Nash's poems went in that direction, but sometimes his verse was poignant indeed, as in the simple poem he called Communion. This table now is simply spread with little loaves of common bread, not pumpernickel, corn, or rye to spark the taste or please the eye, just bread. It's sold in any store. I've had it many times before. I'm accustomed, when a guest, to being rather more impressed. I might expect a gracious host to brown the bread and make some toast, or see his table was arrayed with butter, jam, and marmalade, Danish pastries filled with jam, some scrambled eggs with lots of ham. This would impress me more. Instead, the Lord shares common daily bread. I'll eat this bread, but I will find its taste won't linger in my mind. This bread is easy to dismiss. I've had 10,000 bites like this. This bread, I think, in many ways reminds me of my common days. Some days are vivid in design, resembling an exotic wine. Days of joy or days of sorrow, one may well arrive tomorrow. But nearly all the days I've led are more like this plain, common bread. Like, say, last 19th of September, a day I simply can't remember. It's gone, slipped from my memory, just as this bread is bound to be. And at this table, I shall praise the God who gives me common days. and I shall live these days with pride, knowing God rules by my side. For at this table, God has said, I share with you this daily bread, and by that word, we all are fed. Lord, teach us to number our days, the psalmist said, that we may gain a wise heart, a heart of wisdom. Maybe the grace we have learned here at table is part of the key to such a heart, as it enables us to find contentment and grace in our most common and ordinary days. In one of his journals, the Trappist monk Thomas Merton once scribbled, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, suggested emendation in the Lord's Prayer, take out thy kingdom come, and substitute, give us time. But time has been given to us. The length of our days has been given to us. Even this day has been given to us. So count it as a gift and inhabit it fully. Live it to the limit. Exude gratitude. Respond to grace with grace. Think of it as cardiovascular exercise for a wise heart.